Welcome to Smaller Narratives for a Larger World, brought to you by IASH, Binghamton University's Institute for Advanced Studies in the Humanities. I am your host, Cole Depew, and today we're talking to Carrie Wiggum about the human myth. Carrie is an amazing scholar of genocides and mass atrocity prevention, as well as a brilliant thinker. Today we cover topics such as the Winter Olympics in Beijing as largely propaganda, visiting Auschwitz more times than he'd like to, dark tourism, and the paralysis we feel when confronted by large-scale violence. Fundamental questions that we discuss while we chat about the human myth include: how do we understand the past? How does that understanding shape our public consciousness, our ideas about the future? And how can we understand genocide beyond the horrors? How can we care before the bodies pile up? When do they really begin? These are just some of the topics we touch on, and I learned so much from Carrie. Please feel free to email me at smallernarratives@gmail.com, as well as visit our website, smallernarratives.com, for some of the material and links that we discuss in the show. So without further ado, please enjoy. Thanks. Welcome, everybody. This is Cole, and I'm here with Carrie Wiggum. Great to see you, and really nice to meet you.
Yeah, you as well. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much. So a brief context of the show: we are investigating the human myth, and basically trying to figure out how large narratives, really big, macro, global tales of who is human, what is human, and the stories we tell about humanity in general, is inescapable. So one of the key points of inquiry for this show is just to see how we talk about people and what assumptions we might be making when we do so. So if you wouldn't mind maybe introducing yourself a little bit, what you're interested in, and how you became interested in those things.
Sure. So yeah, as you said, my name is Carrie Wiggum. I'm assistant professor of genocide and mass atrocity prevention at the Institute for Genocide and Mass Atrocity Prevention at Binghamton. And in addition to that academic role, I also have this other part of my life where I work at an international non-governmental organization called the Auschwitz Institute for the Prevention of Genocide and Mass Atrocities. So I'm really both researching societies that are dealing with the legacies of genocide, mass atrocities, and other large-scale identity-based human rights violations. And also working as a practitioner, primarily with policymakers and government officials around the world, trying to help them shape policy to protect whatever identity groups are most vulnerable in their specific context. So when I think about this prompt of what it means to be human, I would say that the way that my work really connects to that is my research focuses on the past, the stories that we tell ourselves about the past, particularly relating to past violence, and how that past continues to impact our present, to shape our views of what the future looks like. So in that sense, and the past is, I mean, thinking about this word of myth, I mean, those stories that we tell ourselves are always a partial story, a created and constructed story. So there, and how that story gets constructed, I would say, really is integral to how we define ourselves as people and what our societies look like. So that's sort of how I would initially connect to that broader theme.
That's so awesome. Yeah. And I think what you're doing is really amazing. So when did you become interested in working on genocide prevention? Do you remember some of the early myths or stories of genocide that maybe like impacted you to do something about it with your life?
So the path that brought me to this field is a long and winding one. I actually began my career as a theater director.
Oh, nice.
So I went to undergrad for that, and then I worked in New York City as a professional theater director for a while, and then decided that I really loved the idea of teaching, and I thought, okay, I could teach at a university to kind of supplement my directing habit financially. But to do that, I needed a graduate degree. But I didn't want to leave New York City because I was working fairly consistently and had an agent and all of that stuff. So I was looking at programs in New York City, and I found that New York University has this graduate degree called in the field of performance studies. And I thought performance studies, like many people do when they first hear that, is about studying theater and sort of traditional performances like that, like dance, music, etc. So I enrolled. And I found out really quickly that while there are people in that program that study what we would traditionally call performance, there are also many of us who study other political or social processes, like activism, like genocide, like religious ritual, through the lens of performance. So it was around the same time that I started my graduate degree that I also met my now husband, who also who founded and run this international NGO that I now work for as well.
Cool.
So he was working in the field of genocide prevention very deeply, and that sort of got me enmeshed in that field too. So all of these things were happening at the same time, and I just gradually became really consumed academically speaking, and then as an activist and practitioner with these issues of preventing atrocities and genocide and identity-based violence. So I started moving away from the theater and moving towards figuring out ways that my research as an academic and as a practitioner could have an impact in those fields. So that's really like the I mean, it's a much longer story than that, but generally how I got to where I am now. And now I still enjoy going to the theater, but my work is really focused on these other kinds of thinking about how societies understand these past, how those past form foundational myths, and narratives in different societies, and how they shape who people are and what can be.
That's so funny. I would never have guessed that is a route to genocide prevention studies and atrocity prevention. That is amazing. So I'd love to get into just some of the basics to start to understand your field of study. So what is public memory? Could you explain that and kind of how it's constructed, maybe in the light of genocide and personal experience, some examples?
Yeah, so that's a much more complicated question than it seems at face value, because I think you could ask a lot of different people,
right,
even just in the field of memory studies, what memory is, and you'll get as many different definitions as people you ask. For me, so the first thing that's important to articulate is that when we talk about memory in this sense, when we're in the sense of genocide or other mass atrocities, we're not talking only about that kind of memory we typically think of as these individual memories of experiences that you or I have had in our lives. So that is certainly a component of it. We're talking about memory more on the level of metaphor. In that sense, what memory is, what public memory is, when we're thinking about genocide, for instance, is exactly the stories that we tell ourselves about the past, the way that that past remains present and shapes our view of the world.
Right.
So it's actually both backward looking, but also very much forward looking, because it's how the past continues to have an impact in our perceptions of the world.
Mm. Wow. So yeah, so we can't access the past from the past. We can only access it from the present. And usually we access the past with some sort of future projection of what to do next, in a way. So it's like we're swiveling between reconstructing a memory that might serve us moving forward.
Yeah, exactly. And the way that we understand the past and the way that we define ourselves based on that past automatically has an impact on what choices we think we can make for the future. It sort of puts constraints over what the possible futures could be. So yeah, that's how it's all sort of connected through memory.
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, it's very similar. It sounds to me similar to private memory as well in identity construction, whereas my past experiences shape who I am and how I deal with situations. And then, you know, at the same time, I'm contextualizing myself within a larger public whole, perhaps.
That's exactly right. And like this field of memory is really like a public memory in this sense sort of emerged. One of the foundational scholars was this French sociologist, Maurice Arbois, who was himself a victim of the Holocaust. But he was the first one to articulate this theory of collective memory. And what he meant by that is not that that term gets used in a lot of different ways now, but what he actually meant by it and the way that he writes about it is the idea that there's actually no such thing as a completely personal or individual memory, because every memory that you or I have is shaped by our social context, by the collectives that we're a part of, shaped by our personal experiences, but also who we're in relationships with, what cultural context we are within. So all of it's there's no such thing as a pure memory. There's no such thing as pure personal experience. We're deeply impacted by everything around us and can't not be.
Yeah, but there is definitely some sort of pressure to feel very private and individual. Like there is a border where my experience is my own. But yeah, sometimes I think, have I ever had an original thought? you know, maybe some gibberish that I've thought, but maybe not, because a lot of what I think is probably cued from my experiences. And I mean, from anything from watching commercials as a kid to, I don't know, like seeing other people behave and wanting to be like them and those kind of things. So is there private experience or memory in your estimate?
I think there's private experience and memory. I don't think there's purely private experience and memory. I mean, talking about human myths, I think one of them is this myth that emerged out of the Enlightenment, the idea that like the liberal subject is this self-contained entity that can exist on its own without being influenced by the world around it. And that's a myth that I think is very central to the way that we understand and structure our society all over the world, not just, but especially in the West and or the global North, we would say now. I think my work really focuses on the ways that we are not just social creatures, our subjective beings are shaped by our relationship with other subjects. We intersubjectivity is at the core of who we are and how we engage with and experience the world.
It's very beautiful to think that way. I do. My main focus of study is eco-criticism, and I try to consider doing that with the non-human world as well, where it's like transcorporeality, which is, we don't think of our skins as these hard borders. We think of them as hard borders, but they're so porous, and our breath, and just, you know, you see this with pollution and climate change, COVID, where, you know, our bodies are not these sealed vessels. Things come in and out, and what we do, you know, to our neighbor or even something across the world will and does have active repercussions, not just in the now, but long ago. So I kind of see that in this memory social context as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the key theoretical fields that I draw from, especially in my first book, which came out recently, is affect studies. And the affect studies is really all based on this exact idea that you're talking about, that our bodies are porous. And it's not only things like pollution or illness that demonstrates that, but also our emotions have a social component. And the way that we feel about others, that whole idea of affect theory is that these emotions are circulating around us and governing our relationships with others and how we relate to others. So yeah, it happens on both a figurative and very real level.
It's like anxiety is contagious.
yeah,
kind of thing. Exactly. Yeah, and someone's nervous. Well, this is really, really cool. I would love to get into just some examples on myths of genocides, and when I say myth, I don't mean conspiracy necessarily. I just mean that, you know, what are the stories, not in a negative kind of connotation, just how we can access them today. But perhaps the Holocaust is a good one. I personally have experienced an American education where I was taught that the United States was the good guys in World War II, and that, you know, nuclear bombing, Japan was for the greater good. The Nazis were pure evil. And some of, you know, some more than others of that is believable. It's a little simplified. But I do wonder kind of how that shaped me, just my student body, my community, just this idea that, you know, and I told you in the notes, those t-shirts that say United States back-to-back World War champs. I just like dealing with World War II as a genocide and a world war. I'm just curious on your thoughts of how do you even start to study genocides in the past? How do you even process things that big? And not to just bombard you with question, but what's really at stake here when we talk about past genocides?
Yeah, well, those are a lot of big questions.
Oh yeah.
I mean, the easiest one is the last. What's at stake?
Okay.
I mean, the reason I study and that I think genocide studies as a field has emerged in the last several decades is because at the core of that is this activist bent, this idea that if we study and come to understand what this big monstrous thing we call genocide is, then we have the opportunity to potentially develop tools to prevent it. Okay. And that's the hope. So there's already this political imperative in the very effort to study the field, at least for me, and I know for many, many others. One of the key things that there's now been that this field has been developed to reveal, I think, is the idea we're transforming the way that we think about genocide, and hopefully transforming the way that most people think about genocide.
Okay.
Especially when the Holocaust happened, in the way, and for many, many decades, genocides were portrayed, especially publicly, as these events, these things that happen almost as if out of nowhere, where all of a sudden large numbers of people were being killed because of who they were or are. And still today, this myth is still pervasive, particularly in the way that media cover, mass media cover genocides, because oftentimes we won't hear about large-scale identity-based violence happening in other places around the world until it's reached a point where huge amounts of people are already being killed. We already have this large number of corpses that are forming these statistics that frame our views of what genocide is. In fact, what we know is that genocides are not events. They are processes. They start with much smaller steps, much earlier stages. And if we don't intercede or try to prevent those earlier stages from escalating, that's when it gets to the point of what we typically label genocide.
Right.
So for instance, when we think about the Holocaust, what we're trying to do is push people not just to think about Auschwitz, which is the end point of a very long process. We're trying to get them to think about the underlying anti-Semitism that had existed for many centuries in Europe and was instrumentalized in a specific moment in Germany and then across Europe. We're trying to get them to think about the rise of Hitler within the context of a huge economic recession that in Germany, thanks to the Great Depression, and also the repercussions of a pretty unfair treaty at the end of World War I, a huge sense of insecurity on the part of the German population, and then political people leaders who stepped in and took advantage of that insecurity and created this other, this threat in the form of not first and foremost Jewish Germans, but also any other identity group who could be seen as a disease to the German people, the Volk, right? So that included, of course, Roma and Sinti people. It included homosexuals, political opponents. All of these people became targets for this violence. And we see that process not, and even when Hitler came to power in 1933, the first goal was not to create these death camps where that we think of like Auschwitz. Mm-hmm. First, there were laws passed to bit by bit, incrementally take away the rights of these identity groups, to remove them from the realm of social responsibility or obligation from other Germans, so that it became bit by bit easier to get to the point where they could be annihilated altogether. Mm. So all of that happened over a very long period of time. There were many points in time that interventions could have happened. And when I say intervention, I don't only mean military intervention, right, was what we typically think of when we hear that word. There are many ways to intervene socially, politically, economically, legally, et cetera. And many steps could have been taken and weren't. And that's especially important to recognize when we think about this hero narrative of the U.S. as this as the savior that comes in and wins World War II for Europe, because when we look at it that way, we see all of these opportunities before the U.S. entered the war in 1941, before the U.S. became specifically involved because of the bombing of Pearl Harbor, for instance, where that the U.S. could have done much more. They knew what was coming. We know that very, very well. None of this was actually a surprise. And yet we chose not to because of an isolationist ideology that was really pervasive at the time. So that's what thinking of it as a process does to help deconstruct some of those myths. And then the other thing I would say, and then I'll stop from going on about this, is that thinking about it as a process also means that we can't think about it as just coming to a clear end when the war ends in 1945 and the U.S. And the other Allied forces defeat the Nazis. In that moment, yes, the physical annihilation, attempted physical annihilation of Jewish Europeans comes to an end. But that doesn't mean all of that violence just stops. It continues in other forms. That anti-Semitism is still there. And there are still also many, many social and political structures that remain in place and that continue the violence against these targeted groups in other forms. Mm-hmm. And that's not unique to the Holocaust. That is something that we see in every single case of genocide and mass atrocity around the world, and something we have to be attentive to, because if we don't pay attention to those legacies of the violence and see it as part of that violence itself that needs to be dealt with, then we're really not doing the real work of preventing it from recurring in the future.
I mean, that was amazing. I just learned so much. I have a bunch of questions. I love the idea of treating these things as a process. I mean, I think that your point too about the media, and I'm even thinking of just a literal book. So you've said you just started, or you just published a book, and we'll have the link to that on our website for sure. But even just the physicality of a book, it has an opening, it has covers. It's a contained thing where there's an intro, a conclusion, you know, table of contents, acknowledgments, and the author needs to make a decision of where to start. Where is it appropriate to start? And that's where the myth begins, because I think there's a value judgment there saying this is where we should begin. Whereas I feel like there could always be a different one. However, just in the medium of books, you can't possibly do everything. So like, and you also can't end it either. Like you're saying, you know, a book about the Holocaust, you couldn't end in 1945. You couldn't end in 1970. You couldn't end in 2022 in a sense, if we're going to kind of treat it as a long process. But I did want to unpack a little bit of the challenges of people, and this is a really kind of crude way to put it, but caring about genocides before there are corpses. And I don't know if you want to use a real-time example of perhaps like the Uyghur camps in China, and maybe tie in some media analysis there of, you know, how does the media treat this? How are Americans viewing themselves in this? Just what are your thoughts on, like, why is it hard to make people care about something so striking and awful?
Yeah. I mean, I think the first answer to that question, because there are many, is we don't want to. We don't want to spend our time thinking about horrible things that are happening around the world, especially if they're not impacting our everyday lives, if they don't actually have a direct impact on our lives. It's easier not to think about those things.
Of course.
Also, even when we do think about those things, let's say the genocide of the Uyghur that's currently happening as we're talking right now,
yep,
in China. Even when we recognize and think about those things, there's a really overriding sense of paralysis that sets in pretty quickly. This right. sense of like, what am I supposed to do? This huge thing is happening and I am one person and I have no idea what I'm supposed to do to help these Uyghurs on the other side of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a super understandable response to that happening. I'm glad you brought up this case of the Uyghur, because just watching the coverage of the Winter Olympics has been challenging. I haven't watched the Olympics myself because I'm participating in the boycott of the Olympics in my small way, that has been called for by the international diaspora Uyghur population. We recently had a really amazing woman, Roshana Boss, as a visitor at the Institute for Genocide and Mass Atrocity Prevention. She's the director and founder of an organization called Campaign for Uyghurs. And if anyone wants more information about the Uyghur genocide and what you can do, I really suggest you look at the Campaign for Uyghurs website, because they do a great job of offering some really concrete steps. But one thing that's amazing that the coverage of the Olympics has shown us is, I mean, it becomes difficult for me to read anything about the Olympics that doesn't address it as an attempt by the Chinese government to cover up and make acceptable the large-scale human rights violations that they're perpetrating every day. It is watching propaganda. And it's real. And I'm not saying that everyone, the athletes who are participating, are willing and active contributors to that propaganda. But one thing that I think that I hope they realize is that, in fact, they are being used as a tool. And the IOC is being used as a tool to allow China to perpetrate genocide. So, and when I hear Thomas Bach, the president of the IOC, hide behind this ideology of being non-political,
right,
I just want to die, because that is not an ethical stance to take in the face of genocide. There's no such thing. You cannot be non-political when it comes to genocide. You must take a stance, and there's nothing honorable about not taking a stance when people are being murdered. Mm-hmm. And their culture is being destroyed. And this is not unique to the genocide of the Uyghur, but it's something we have to attend to when we see things like the Olympics taking place. As I said, there are many other examples of this. In one of the things I study a lot is Argentina and the military dictatorship of 1976 to 83 that happened there, when as many as 30,000 Argentinian citizens were disappeared because they were political opponents to the military regime. And during the height of those disappearances in 1978, Argentina hosted the World Cup. Oh. Soccer tournament, and in fact won the World Cup that year.
Mm-hmm.
And while Argentina, the national team, were winning the championship match in the River Plate Stadium in Buenos Aires. Less than 1 mile away, there were political opponents and disappeared people being tortured in the largest concentration and detention center. And they reported being able to hear the cheers of their fellow countrymen and women in the stadium while the World Cup match was happening. And the military regime was using that World Cup match as a tool for covering up the human rights abuses they were perpetrating. So this happens again and again, and it's completely unacceptable. And I think we have responsibilities to express the fact that that should be unacceptable when we see it happening. That's such a diatribe I just went on, but
that's why
my soapbox.
Podcasting is so great because you get to get into those deep thoughts. I mean, yeah, I recently heard the term sports washing, which is and I heard that before the Olympics. Well, there's an NBA player, his name is Enes Kanter, and the NBA has a really complicated and they try to demoralize the situation with China. So basically, China is a huge market share of the NBA as a product. And so whenever China, the government in China is upset with, some sort of activist lean from a very social justice heavy brand, which is the NBA, they censor, Daryl Morey was a coach who, for the Houston Rockets, who tweeted against the occupation in Hong Kong, and he was fired. He had to apologize. LeBron James said he was uneducated about it. And then Enes Kanter wore shoes that said like genocide Olympics. And now he's not playing anymore. And you just see it's kind of similar where, sports are not political, but the world is political. And sports are such a center meeting place of minds and people, and it's a common ground. And there's I understand not wanting politics in sports, but sports are political. And especially with the Olympics, I haven't watched them either, but when I did watch, it was cringy to kind of hear the fallacy of the middle ground, like the journalism bias, where it's like, let's interview one person who says that the Uyghur situation is an overreaction in the public. And let's hear someone who thinks it's not, let's have a civil debate. And then let's show a couple pictures of like mountain ranges in the back and snowboarders. And I'm just like, oh, this is so bad. And yet as a person, like you're saying, who is experiencing paralysis, experiencing helplessness, and I'm experiencing a lot of my agency in the world as a person is consumerism, which is like, I'm within this paradigm where a lot of my influence is with my credit card. And so, basically I don't watch something which is passive, which doesn't feel great. Like it doesn't feel like I'm doing anything. So those are my thoughts on it. I mean, I love sports. I love snowboarding. I love hockey. I love figure skating for some reason. I think it's so like nerve-wracking, but I can't get down with watching it in China and kind of letting it be some PR, the world's getting along thing either. So I definitely feel helpless and bummed. And I also feel the urge to the cognitive dissonance urge to watch it anyway and not care, because I'm privileged enough to not be directly affected. So I don't know if you have any response to that, but we can also talk about other stuff.
No, I agree. It resonates with me.
Yeah. Oh man. So I wanted to talk to you a little bit about public memory sites. Have you been to Auschwitz, the camp there?
Yeah, too many times.
Too many times, yeah.
I can't count. Because one of the things that we do at the Auschwitz Institute is our flagship program is called the Raphael Lemkin Seminar for Genocide Prevention. Mm-hmm. Raphael Lemkin was the Polish Jew who coined the term genocide. Most people think it's an old term. It actually was first written in 1944 by Lemkin. He came up with it. He created the term to give a name to what was happening and what had happened in Armenia and what was happening to his family, actually, during the Holocaust. Genocide comes from the Greek genos, meaning race or tribe, and side from the Latin, meaning to kill. So anyway, we have this seminar, which brings policymakers from countries all over the world to Auschwitz for 1 week, to the camp. And we stay together. We stay there for 1 week. And we start by learning about the Holocaust and that process that led to the creation of Auschwitz. But then the rest of the week is spent on, okay, so what do we do today? What are the tools that we can take to do what we call upstream, midstream, and downstream prevention, the actions we can take before, during, and after mass atrocities to make sure that they don't occur or that they come to an end as quickly as possible. So that takes place in Auschwitz, partly because of the power of that place to put everyone in this specific mindset. So, I and my research is specifically on memory sites and memorials. So I've spent way more of my life visiting sites of death and violence than most people would ever want. And that includes many, many visits to Auschwitz, which is a strange thing to say, but yeah.
So yeah, that's, I mean, I've never been there, but I wanted to get your take on the idea of dark tourism. So yeah, what you just said, you know, as it's kind of a two-way street where the power of being there is impactful and important because, you know, it's, there's probably, you know, a certain spirit to that area, I mean, that we can sense or, you know, create or however that occurs. But there's also people who go to Auschwitz for like a vacation in a way, you know, like, so I just, you know, where, as someone who goes there as a scholar or someone who's studying the area, I feel like that's different. But what is your kind of interaction with so-called dark tourists? And is it a good thing to do? Because I think we do want to remember, but I also don't think we want to visit, vacation, get a magnet kind of thing. I don't know.
Yeah, it's, yeah. Again, it's a really complicated question. I don't think it's all good or all bad.
Right.
It's true that I think a lot of people, their visit to Auschwitz is part of this, you know, you know, what I often think of as like this Disney tour of Europe where, you know, they go to the Eiffel Tower in France, they go to the, you know, take a gondola ride in Venice, and then, and then visiting Auschwitz is like visiting the, you know, the haunted mansion of Disney, right? Like it's, and it's sort of a thing you tick, a box you tick off on this list of places you're supposed to visit. And then, you know, after spending your day at Auschwitz, you go back into Krakow, beautiful, Krakow, Poland, and go to a you know, a nice pub and sort of move on with your life. A lot of people, I think, visit Auschwitz and other memory sites around the world, and they'll often talk about it as a really central and moving and life-changing experience. I think it's hard to evaluate exactly how life-changing it is and what the impact of that visit is on their continuing life. And I mean, of course, it's hard to isolate that one experience of visiting Auschwitz for one day. How to isolate that from all of the other things that are impacting us as people throughout our lives. That's why, I mean, one of the things that I'm really obsessed with studying is this exact thing, the impact of these sites of memory. One thing I think that, the way that we talk about memory sites and memorials, there's this idea of this motif of never again that gets reiterated again and again, that and which presumes that simply by building or demarcating these spaces, all that act on its own is going to be preventive, that that's going to stop the recurrence of violence. There's this precept by the philosopher George Satayana that gets said again and again, of he who does not remember the past is condemned to repeat it. The idea that simply remembering the past means that we're going to not repeat it again. And I think that that's an incredibly naive view of memory. It requires a lot more than just remembering in order to stop something from recurring. So what I really focus on in my work are looking at sites that don't just exist, but that are actually doing things and engaging with populations and publics more actively in the present. I think Auschwitz and the people at the Auschwitz-Birkenau State Museum, the institution that runs that space, are doing great work. They are challenged by the fact that most people are visiting Auschwitz one time in their life. They will never go back again. They're not like me. They're going like twice a year, right? Like they're going once in their life and they never want to go back because it is a terrible experience. It's a terrible place to experience. So that's really challenging to have a continuing impact in this one time, like this few hours that you get to interact with someone. There are a lot of other really amazing memory sites and initiatives that are happening in other places around the world, however, that I think are trying to take advantage of the opportunity to engage with people much more intimately and much more repeatedly over time. Mm-hmm. So I mentioned, for instance, ESMA, which was the largest clandestine detention and torture center in Argentina. Yeah. And that's a space that, unlike Auschwitz, which is sort of removed from the city centers and public life, you have to take a journey to get there. ESMA is in the middle of Buenos Aires. Mm. And while it does offer tours for visitors who are coming to Buenos Aires, you know, to and they want to see this museum and learn about this past, and they'll go once in their life, they also make some really amazing efforts to engage with the local population on a continuous basis. So instead of just having this museum, they also have a cultural center that has theatrical productions, art exhibitions, film screenings. They have a library, a bookstore, a cafe. They also house 20 plus human rights organizations that are doing work on human rights protections today in Argentina on the grounds of this site. So this space of death has become this incredibly vibrant space for promoting and protecting human rights in the present. And it's become this space where people in Buenos Aires will go there, not just once in their lifetime, maybe once a month, once a week even, to engage in any of these numerous activities that are happening there. And that's what I see as the real, there being real, that's when I see real potential for long-term impact on changing someone's behavior. That's where I see this so-called dark tourism as having a real, like moving beyond just that tourism movement, to being something bigger, to having this bigger impact. Not every site has the opportunity to do that. People aren't going to go to Auschwitz more than once. People aren't going to go to the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum more than once or twice in their lives, most likely. But these other very local sites are finding some really creative ways when you look at it for more longer term engagement. And that's where I see real hope for sites of memory as having a real preventive impact.
Yeah, I do think like the never forget sentiment is beautiful and so important. But I do understand that memory is fallible and it is convenient because we can change it in a moment's notice. So I can forget certain things if I need to and want to. But I did want to ask this question because I feel like a lot of our conversation has been about observing these things, right, from a distance. I wanted to ask what do you think needs to happen for someone like me or you to end up being on the oppressive side of a genocide? Because what was going through my mind, and I don't know if you're aware of Call of Duty, the video game, but there's a whole expansion pack of it called Nazi Zombies, which is a very popular feature of the game where you kill, guess what, Nazi zombies with a teammate. And they, you know, each round there's more of them. And I wonder kind of what that does to that retroactive public memory, that construction, and what the kind of that, you know, dehumanizes the perpetrator, which is, you know, it doesn't seem like a bad thing, but I do think that it thwarts any empathy or understanding or prevention, like you said. So I don't know, what needs to happen for like a good person to get to that point where they're, say, a Nazi soldier or someone in Argentina, like, you know, torturing people next to the FIFA World Cup?
Yeah, this is one of the central questions that the field of genocide studies, particularly those who are looking like social psychologists working in the field, have been studying for a long time. And one of the preeminent scholars on this is a colleague of mine at the Auschwitz Institute, James Waller, who wrote a really central text called Becoming Evil, How Ordinary People Commit Mass Atrocities or Mass Killing. Mm-hmm. That I would recommend to anyone interested in these topics. Ultimately, the answer to your question is what it takes for people to reach this point is a lot less than we think it does. We have this tendency, and it's an understandable tendency, when we see or hear about genocides happening elsewhere, to think about the perpetrators of those genocides as monsters, mm-hmm. as inherently evil. What's interesting about that impulse is that it's actually the same underlying impulse that is necessary for a genocide to take place to begin with. Right. It's this need to other, to remove someone from the realm of who we are and put them in another box that we could never be a part of because it's something else altogether. Mm. And that process of othering is central. But Waller in his book talks about three different processes that happen that turn ordinary people, mm-hmm. because ultimately the people who are perpetrating mass atrocities are no different from you and me. Mm-hmm. They are people who are part of larger processes, a cultural worldview that's constructed that allows for certain, for instance, following orders, listening to authority more or less than others. They're people who have become inculcated by a psychological viewpoint where this view of the other has been constructed. And that other, and that worldview basically says, not only is it not wrong for that other to be killed, mm-hmm. it's actually wrong to not kill yeah. the other. That's the inversion that happens in the genocide. And they also become part of social networks and this social construction of cruelty where they become professionalized within ranks, oftentimes of a security sector, military or police, mm-hmm. Where to fit in, one has to join in these processes of othering and ultimately these processes of killing. So all of these things are happening. And that's how ordinary people become the perpetrators. It's really easy to just say that people are crazy or mad. But when we really look at the evidence, that's not what's happening at all. Ordinary people are being put into circumstances that transform them into killers. Now, what I want to be clear on is that by saying that and by analyzing those processes whereby ordinary people become killers, that's not to excuse their behavior. Mm. That's not to say, oh, well, now we can understand how perpetrators are created and therefore they should get a pass and they're not really guilty because they're just victims of a system, yeah. right? No. But if we understand those processes whereby people are transformed into killers, that also gives us opportunities for, again, intervening so that those processes aren't able to be fulfilled, so mm-hmm. that people don't make those steps and become killers. But yeah, this is a central aspect of genocide studies and genocide prevention, is understanding that any of us can become killers. That's not to say that all of us will, but when we learn to recognize the processes whereby that happens, we can take actions to prevent it from happening.
Yeah, it's just that we're so inherently social creatures, terrified of being ostracized, that the social cost of not being doing horrible things is being like outcast. And for us as people, sometimes that's worse. And it, maybe it's even worse than out being outcast, for example. But, you know, it makes me think of the same other side of that coin where people say, I would never have been a victim. I would have done something about it. How would people have let that get so bad? And I mean, I think that argument is a little harder to digest, and there's some ego involved there, and maybe some, you know, revisionist history or whatever, romanticism. But it's the same kind of thing where, you know, like, all right, I'm othering the victims and the perpetrators. I'm just this virtuous person who would have like whistled through all of that and not had to pick a side, so to speak.
Yeah, I mean, my answer to that, I mean, you're right. Yeah, like everyone wants to think of themselves as noble and someone who would have stood up or be a resistor in the midst of this. But then I would just ask that person, or point out to that person that we are all right now bystanders to several genocides that I can just name off the top of my head, or other mass atrocities that are happening right now around the world and doing nothing about it. And that includes in the U.S., in our home country. I mean, years ago, and really in many ways, this policy is continuing. We were seeing the separation of children from their parents on the U.S.-Mexico border, which is really, in my view, a crime against humanity, which is a kind of mass atrocity crime that was happening in the U.S. And yet, how many U.S. Americans were standing up and actively fighting against that? Of course, we can think about the systematic oppression of Black people in the United States, both in the way that policing happens in the U.S. And through many, many of the structures happening. And yet, right now we've got a debate about whether or not critical race theory can be taught in schools. And what we mean by critical race theory is talking about race in any way whatsoever as a defining factor of experience in the United States today. So we're all bystanders at many points, including myself, to many, many different atrocities. There's always more that can be done.
Yeah, I remember learning. So it's an uncomfortable question to pose. And I don't know how much like person. I mean, I do think there's personal responsibility, but I also think that there is. There's different levels of taking responsibility to this. So I remember learning that people in prisons do forced labor for free and produce like goods that I eat. Like I know and this happens in America with potatoes and other manufacturing textiles. But I remember specifically learning that prisoners in China peel garlic, and the majority of the peeled garlic that is in our stores were peeled by prisoners. And this is not like a fun task. Like it ruins their hands. And the powerlessness that I feel like, okay, again, a consumer, I don't buy garlic, but I don't go and pick it. I don't go and rally the troops, so to speak, about any of this. Like I am very complicit. I can make all the excuses I want. And there's competing values in just an everyday day-to-day life. Like, you got to take care of families, enjoy life, be grateful. But you're right. It's happening right now. Like there's slavery in America right now in the prison system, I hope, the next generation challenges me and says, well, why didn't you do anything about it? And I think there's a lot of anticipation of those questions in the future for a lot of things, climate, democracy, genocide, of course. Maybe just kick the can down the road kind of thing. It's hard to digest it all.
It's really difficult, and it's overwhelming, right? When we confront these realities, and there are certainly things that I could be doing that I'm not doing, that I'm not, because it's just so much. There's so much bad happening. Mm-hmm. I justify it to myself by saying, we all do what we can do, and as long as you feel like you're doing as much as you are capable of doing, mm-hmm. Then that's, you know, you have to give yourself a break at some point too.
Yeah.
I don't know if that might just be me letting myself off the hook too much, but, like you said, we're responsible to ourselves too. And making ourselves into miserable people doesn't help anyone.
No.
Taking care of ourselves so that we can take care of others can also be self-care is also should be a form of setting us up to take care of others and select the causes that we care about. We can't do everything. Everyone can do something, right? And the other thing I say again and again is that, you know, we have to learn to celebrate little victories mm-hmm. along the way, because ultimately when we're talking about these huge issues like genocide and mass atrocities, all there are little victories. Mm-hmm. It's very rare that you find something that, like, you know, where everything gets suddenly better completely. It just doesn't happen. So you have to celebrate the little victories. You have to take care of yourself along the way. And yet still always challenge yourself to do everything you can that you're capable of.